We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 14, Hogwarts Bullies. Joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Catherine Kittredge and Carolyn Rennie about the bullying going on at Hogwarts and why it might not be exactly what you think. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions and cultural competency at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today we're going to be talking about some of the dynamics among Hogwarts students, particularly those dynamics that manifest as bullying. Now, Emily, when the topic of bullying comes up, what do you tend to think about?
Well, if I'm being entirely honest, the first image that comes to my mind is one of our previous president, Donald Trump. And I hope it's not alienating to anybody to hear me say that. Because I think even people who voted for Trump and maybe even like Trump will concede that he has a sort of bullying sort of persona. And then that's kind of part of his brand, you know, for him to engage in those sorts of relationships with people who he feels are lesser. So it was an interesting 4 years during his presidency because, you know, usually you point your kid to the president and say, you know, look, this person is, you know, somebody we can emulate in these ways. But I found myself more often, you know, pointing to him with my son, you know, and saying, well, this is something not to do. This is something not to do. Because I was raised by a fifth grade teacher. And, you know, my mom was even a teacher in my school. And so she was very sensitive to bullying. And she encouraged all of us to kind of be especially on the lookout for bullying. And so I don't know if that was just her role as a teacher or what. So, if I'm being honest, Katie, that's my answer. What about you?
Right. Okay. So I guess I was thinking about it definitely in the school context. I mean, I do agree with you wholeheartedly. And I just, as you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, that debate that was supposed to be like a town hall debate with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, where he was always kind of moving shark-like in the background, that there are these kind of elements of physical intimidation. And I think I tend to think about bullying as, you know, more the kind of physical intimidation that comes in the school setting. And I know the schools are now actually they're trying to make kids conscious of it, and the schools are being conscious that this is something that happens in school dynamics a lot. And they're trying to teach kids strategies to deal with bullying. One of the things that I think is a little tougher is trying to realize when you're being a bully, you know, and I think about that with the other thing that I sort of try to remind myself is also bullying is the mean girls stuff, which is not so much about physical intimidation as it is about, you know, the kind of psychological, emotional, the social group dynamic.
Right, the gaslighting.
Yeah, and some of those exclusionary, you know, little group think things that happen in those kinds of settings. And so, you know, one of the things that's really interesting that we're going to be talking about more today are the ways that our understanding of bullying has maybe changed. And bullying as something, you know, that kids have to deal with, and bullying as a part of the life experience, you know, of growing up. and right. what we think about it. And the pre-Victorians that we are going to be talking about in Britain, they had some slightly different ideas about bullying in the school setting than maybe what we do today. And so I think that'll be really interesting.
I agree. Can't wait.
So we are very pleased today to have joining us Dr. Catherine Kittredge and Carolyn Rennie. Catherine has been teaching children's literature, women's studies, and science fiction courses at Ithaca College for 30 years. She has published articles on a wide range of topics, including Jane Austen, children's fantasy, the I Hate to Cook cookbook, and South Park. Meanwhile, Carolyn is a 2017 graduate of Ithaca College and a 2020 graduate of the University of Connecticut Law School. Congratulations, Carolyn. That's a very recent graduation. Well, when she's not doing her work as an aspiring litigator at a Boston law firm, Carolyn is a lifelong Harry Potter fan and hopes to continue engaging critically with the series and young adult pop culture generally. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much for having us. This is really exciting.
Yeah, I'm delighted to be able to reunite with Carolyn and talk about Harry Potter again.
You two were professor and student at Ithaca College working on this paper together, right?
I had started working on a paper about pre-Victorian bullying. And as I was progressing with the research, I just kept getting like flashes of similarities to Harry Potter. And I had known Carolyn since literally, I think, her first days at college and known her as a devoted Harry Potter fan. And so I thought, I need to check with Carolyn about this. And she found some great stuff.
I think that's a wonderful example of like the collaboration that can happen, you know, at these college settings. Carolyn, you say you're a lifelong Harry Potter fan, huh?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, my Harry Potter journey mirrors that of many young millennials. You know, I was a child when the books came out and I didn't like reading, couldn't sit still that long. But then I got hooked on Harry Potter and just could not put it down and just discovered reading from there. And, you know, it's no small thing to say that I owe a lot of my, like, you know, achievements in academics to Harry Potter first hooking me in. Yeah, my first year of college, first day, I took Professor Kittredge's first year seminar, which that was my real first exposure to feminism and women's studies at all. I came from a kind of conservative town in Connecticut. So that really, you know, opened my eyes. And so I was just so hooked. She was such a fantastic teacher of those subjects, as well as, you know, teaching us about college and about growing up and about this phase of our lives. And so I took as many courses with her as I could. And then she brought me in on this Harry Potter project and, you know, taught me how to navigate JSTOR and showed me how to research and just, you know, further opened my eyes to this whole other way of thinking about pop culture and about all of the content that I was already consuming. Really excited to be able to reunite with her on this again.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that I think Harry Potter does so well, right? It brings people together across, you know, fields and interests in ways that are sometimes unpredictable. And the two of you work together on this chapter that appears in Cruel Children in Popular Texts and Culture, which came out from Palgrave in 2018, edited by Flagel and Parks. And your article is titled Old School Bullies at Hogwarts, the Pre-Victorian Roots of J.K. Rowling's Depiction of Child-on-Child Violence. So it's a nice marriage of Catherine's and your interest in the pre-Victorian school stories and also, you know, looking at Harry Potter, looking at Hogwarts.
Yeah, it's a really great article, especially in that many of your conclusions are not, well, they're very insightful. They're unexpected. At least they were to me when I was reading. So as Katie said, your article focuses on bullying in Harry Potter. What makes a bully? And has our idea of what constitutes bullying or being a bully, has that changed over time?
I work primarily in the 18th century, although as my publication show, I kind of bop around a bit. So in the 18th century, there was a feeling that children were naturally inclined to bully, that in one text I looked at, it's a story of a girl going to school and her mother says, you know, kids are going to bully each other the same way that a cat naturally wants to play with a mouse. So it was seen as innate and natural. And usually the bullying was by a privileged child towards a less privileged child, or by a child who would be considered normal or competent towards a child who had difficulties or differences in some ways. So it was a way of, for children to kind of identify their status and to make other children aware of where they stood. Then as we move into the 19th century, we begin to have a real shifting and towards an idea of bullies as children who are, instead of being the norm, persecuting the different, we begin to see the bullies as children who are different. They're kids who didn't really stack up with their peers and who are picking on smaller children because they're insecure or because there's something emotionally wrong with them. So we go from bullying being the norm to bullying being a deviant behavior over the span of, say, the shift happens in maybe 30 years towards the start of the Victorian era.
Wow, that's really fascinating. I think it shows also the ways that our understanding of children and childhood are definitely bound by our cultural context and the time in which we're living. The idea that children are sort of natural predators, I think, is fascinating.
Right.
And it's really different from, we have these, you know, children are like inherently little angels. We talk about children as being angels all the time, and that's just not the 18th century point of view. And then also how interesting that the idea that you would, you know, express yourself in bullying behavior as deviant or reflective of some kind of internal flaw or weakness, I think is sort of fascinating as well.
I think we maybe go more towards that today. The idea that if a child is bullying, it's because there's some sort of problem there, that they have psychological issues of their own, or they may have experienced some kind of trauma.
That is coming through a lot in like looking at ways that bullying has evolved. Like you were mentioning earlier, Dr. McDaniel, you were mentioning Mean Girls and the ways in like that film, as well as that kind of idea of adolescent girls, the way that the aggression between them takes on a new form and a new kind of vehicle as girls mature, or not so much mature, as age into adolescence, and bullying being like a group dynamic, and how girls are navigating groups, and, you know, manipulation and a lot of rumor mill kind of stuff. You know, the slam book that we see in that movie. And then even moving past sort of a 2010 into like where we are now with social media, and how image focused a society we've become. And so the bullying that happens on social media and in, you know, girls, but, you know, children of all genders really experiencing insecurity about like the standards that are established among children and adolescents about their image, and the shaming that can go on those platforms. And all of that being really like, it's going both ways. There's not really a kind of one sided, like there's a bully who has a lot of power and a victim who has no power, because the ways in which things go viral on social media, in social media communities localized to certain towns and schools, like, you know, a child can be a bully one minute and then a victim the next. And so it's just kind of creating a new dynamic that is very volatile and very fast and very fast spreading, very wildfire like.
Yeah, that's fascinating, right? And it's not like it's a static identity. This person's always the bully, but that it can be fluid and it's changing. So, Catherine, most people talk about Harry Potter and they liken it, you know, to school stories, and they're looking at the school context. It's been very common to reference particularly Tom Brown's School Days, which is a Victorian School Days novel. But you have focused on these earlier texts that really predate Tom Brown and that are actually pretty different in terms of some of the ways that they're presenting school dynamics. Can you tell us a little bit about how the school stories are different before Tom Brown, and especially in the way that they present these power dynamics among students?
I think I have to sort of go back and talk a little bit about what was happening in boarding schools, especially what were considered to be the great boarding schools, so Eton, Rugby, Harrow, right before the Victorian era. So there's a long tradition of kids going off to boarding schools, specifically boys going off often at very young ages, like 6 or 7. And the idea was that you took them out of the home because their mothers were going to make them effeminate, and that they were being sent off to boarding school as a way to make them masculine and to toughen them up. The boys' schools have been called this is from the historian Jeffrey Richards, self-governing boy republics, tribal, turbulent, and brutal. So often the adults really weren't present at all. So it was a place being run basically by adolescent boys with very small boys under their control. And the adults thought that basically this is what had to happen in order to create, you know, real British men. And then as we move into the 1830s, what happens is, and this is when Thomas Hughes, who wrote Tom Brown's School Days, was going to school. You have the rise of much more thoughtful education and the idea that adults should be shaping children. So there is a headmaster at Rugby, which is where Thomas Hughes went, named Thomas Arnold, who was famous for sort of micromanaging kids, being very aware of them, being very present in their lives, asking them to be better, to put aside their natural bullying tendencies and to become empathetic and nurturing. So a lot of what we see shifting in the school stories as we're moving towards Tom Brown's School Days is the actual shifting that's happening in educational thought and in kids' actual experiences at school.
I'm really interested in what you had to say. I was familiar with the Tom Brown School Days and that sort of the sort of tropes of that genre as it kind of solidifies with Tom Brown School Days. But you and Carolyn made a study of these pre-Victorian school stories. And curiously, and probably counterintuitively for us today, given what we've already said about bullying in our modern society, you found that a lot of these novels, the pre-Victorian novels, see bullying as a positive force. Now, how can that be?
Bullying is seen, well, so we start off by saying that bullying is really a natural thing for kids to do. But it was also seen as a way, so at this time, there's also this rise of this idea that and John Locke is part of this, the philosopher. He felt that children should be controlled by shame rather than by physical punishment. And so if you have a child who's not working up to grade level or their capacity, you want to embarrass them. And frequently then they would use their peers to try to encourage them to work harder. So on one hand, it's a way of trying to make less capable students better. It's also a way of trying to teach kids to control their emotions. So frequently, victims of bullies, in addition to being kids who are less competent, might be kids who are overly sensitive. The poet Percy Bysshe Shelley was horribly bullied, and it was thought that this was for his own good. You know, it was openly understood that he needed to toughen up and be more of a normal kid. So a lot of this is about trying, using other children to apply peer pressure to enforce the norms.
One of the things I think is really interesting about that is, you know, that it's coming out of that Enlightenment era where you're supposed to be a reasoning person. I mean, Locke thinks that's what makes people people, is because they're rational. So the idea was that you were supposed to be a rational person and you were supposed to have the emotion, you know, shamed out of you or drummed out of you so that you could toughen up, as you say. And I'm also really struck by the gender dynamic at work there in that idea of toughening up. I feel like it's coming from that same don't cry, be a man place that I think a lot of people have been trying to challenge more recently. And there is this there's this interesting dynamic, and I was sort of aghast when you were talking about they have to take the little boys away from their mothers when they're like 7 years old so they don't make them effeminate, you know? And and so I'm really interested in the gender dynamic of bullying in these earlier texts. And you know, is this why bullying itself tends to be something we think of as a, more of a masculine kind of power dynamic?
I think this goes along with some of the things Carolyn was saying before about the kind of mean girls bullying. Most of the school stories, the school texts, are about all male groups, but there are a smaller number of them that look at girls' boarding schools. And the kind of bullying that we see there is mostly sort of socially based. So they might be like the shaming of a girl from a less wealthy background, or manipulation through spreading rumors or lying, or somehow getting teachers to dislike the heroine because they tell stories there. So with girls, it tends to be very rarely physical, often around gaslighting or bending the truth. And again, pointing out differences in social class or behavior, like a girl who cries a lot or seems overly sensitive might be teased for her own good, just as boys would be.
My mind is also going right to Harry Potter when we're talking about both of these kinds of bullying dynamics. And I guess it's actually not both. There are a lot of kind of bullying dynamics that we've been talking about. So where do we see some echoes of these pre-Victorian school stories in the Harry Potter series?
I think that we see a lot of those echoes in the ways, especially with respect to James Potter and Draco Malfoy being the sort of prime examples, the ways in which the bullying that they are engaged in is, like Catherine said, it's sort of part of their development. It's part of the development of the characters around them. Like when when Harry is confronting Lupin and Sirius about how Sirius and James had bullied Snape, and their assurance to Harry is that James grew out of it. It was part of maturing. He was one of the smartest kids in school. He succeeded in everything he did, and he sometimes got a little carried away, and that was natural and expected. And similarly with Draco, he is reacting to the pressures that his family is putting on him, the things that he's been taught by his father, who is himself a bully. And that evolves as the series goes on, you know, takes a different form as Draco starts to care less about bullying Harry and more about, you know, supporting Voldemort, and then ultimately changing when Draco kind of comes to, at certain points, decide not to support Voldemort. Like, you know, when Harry's captive at Malfoy Manor and Draco has the opportunity to turn Harry in and identify him, and he chooses not to because he's, at that point, he's less concerned about bullying Harry, less concerned about fulfilling Voldemort's agenda, and more concerned about sort of things that are bigger than himself, like the safety of his family.
That's interesting. With Draco, I think you can also kind of take that into Cursed Child, although I know a lot of people don't want to go there. But you know, Draco as an adult has definitely matured out of some of those bullying behaviors that he had expressed in school. So I think maybe he's not dissimilar to James Potter on that. Oh, I'll let our listeners engage with us on whether you think James and Draco have a similar trajectory.
Carolyn, you mentioned James and you mentioned Draco, but who else might you count among the bullies of Hogwarts, and why?
There really are a lot of bullies in Harry Potter. I mean, the first example that we see is Dudley Dursley, and the other Dursleys too, but Dudley especially. And then of course James and Sirius, Draco and his father Lucius. Snape is definitely a bully. Dolores Umbridge has got bullying behaviors. Both of them you know, towards towards other adults, but also towards the children that they're interacting with. And that difference in power dynamic, I think, doesn't negate that some of those behaviors really are bullying. We see that in Tom Riddle. I mean, in the flashbacks as a child, his violence definitely started as bullying other children at the orphanage, other children right. at Hogwarts. But also another example that I think of all the time is Rita Skeeter. She is, Ooh. I think, she's a really good example of the ways in which bullying takes on a gendered dynamic. She's like a sort of classic Regina George mean girl. So I think that's really interesting. And there are a lot of other characters that are bullies at times. Cornelius Fudge, you know, Barty Crouch Jr., that time that he turns Malfoy into a ferret. mm-hmm. you know, there are a lot of bullies.
Yeah, and I was thinking about Luna, not that she's a bully, but that she does get bullied. But the source of her bullying is not always clear. You know, we know that it's right. kind of widespread, but it's not really given a face.
That's another good example, too, of there's a bullying. There's a sort of bullying that happens in a mob mentality kind of way, when it seems like maybe the entire school or just an entire house gangs up on one character or another. Luna is definitely a perpetual victim of that. But also, but Harry, we see that a lot, like, you know, in book one, when Harry loses all those house points and the entire Gryffindor house and even Ravenclaw and Hufflepuff turn against him. And they're bullying him in a sort of mob mentality kind of way. We see that all the way at different times in the series, all the way through book five, when everyone in the school thinks that Harry's being a liar about Voldemort coming back. And so they all are collectively bullying him. There's a kind of fickle mob mentality kind of group bullying by the nameless and faceless masses of Hogwarts students.
Right. The Potter stinks crowd.
Yes. The Potter stinks badges. Yep.
Another thing that this is really bringing up, I mean, when we're talking about how widespread bullying is that in some ways, even though Dumbledore is a very powerful figure, there's a lot of kind of anarchy in Hogwarts. There's a sense of the children mm-hmm. really running things for themselves, really controlling each other's experience far more than the teachers do. It seems like we rarely see teachers stepping in to prevent or mitigate bullying. And the children, I mean, with Dumbledore's army, we see the children as kind of a force very separate from the adults and making their own rules and making their own kind of hierarchies and decisions about what is good and what is bad.
I think that seems to me to be a difference between the British school stories that in that it's not so much that the adults don't know that it's going on. You know, Dumbledore has his eyes and ears everywhere in Hogwarts, and all the teachers, to a lesser extent, they pick up on it. They know that there's, you know, house rivalry that leads to a lot of bullying over Quidditch and over the house cup. And they know when Harry is being bullied by the teeming horde of students. And it's kind of an affirmative choice not to engage and to let this, you know, sort of child anarchy run rampant.
Yeah, that really, when you were talking about the adults being kind of absent, or, you know, in the pre-Victorian school stories, I did think, you know, Dumbledore's always off doing something else when, you know, you sort of think, who's watching? Who's watching Hogwarts? Who's making sure things are okay there? And, you know, I'm very interested in this, you know, this idea that the kind of pre-Victorian stories are influencing J.K. Rowling. And I wonder if, do you think that she kind of agrees that there is some sort of benefit for the kids to figure these things out themselves?
I think it's not just through school stories, but I think that our culture overall has a very sort of troubled relationship with bullying, because on one hand, you know, we all know bullying is bad. We know that it causes trauma. And yet there are a lot of people who feel that you have to let children work things out for themselves, regardless of the damage. And I think in some ways this is almost underestimating children, like believing that what children do to each other isn't significant. Perhaps that it's something that in the long run will work out and will be to the good. In the other article I published on this, which was in The Lion and the Unicorn, long, well-established journal on children's lit. Mm-hmm. I actually quote the comedian Chris Rock, who talks about being shaped by bullies and feeling like bullies are as essential to children's education as teachers are.
That's really interesting and problematic on a lot of levels. It's like, you know, the what harm can children do attitude does seem sort of turning a blind eye at best, you know, to the harm they really can do. And, you know, I mean, in Harry Potter, the bullying is such a complex issue. There's probably no, you know, one of the most gut-wrenching episodes, you know, as you're reading through, you know, as a first-time reader, is when Harry sees that memory of Snape's of James and Sirius bullying him.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. the realization that his own father, who he admired, whose Patronus he conjures, you know, and whose spirit lives in him, was something of a bully. And yet it has the effect of humanizing bullies themselves. What do you think is the effect? First of all, do you think that readers, you know, what age do you have to be to get that lesson? And, you know, do you think all readers get that lesson? And what is the effect of humanizing bullies like this in the text?
I mean, first I'll say that I think the lesson itself is pretty pretty nuanced and pretty complicated. I mean, the implication from what Lupin says is definitely that, you know, people gain maturity over time and they age out of bullying. And it seems to track with respect to Lupin himself, because in that interaction, he reflects on how he has come to learn that it was wrong for him not to intervene, especially because he was a prefect, and because he was made a prefect with the idea of curbing James and Sirius's behavior. But I'm not sure that lesson tracks with respect to Sirius, because
right.
he still maintains a really vicious opposition to Snape, definitely rooted in the bullying that they engaged as children. Now, how much can we read into that, given that Sirius, it's kind of clear that he's pretty emotionally stunted from his time in Azkaban, that the way that he balances a tight line between like a father figure to Harry, but then kind of reverting back to more of a brother, more of a friend, mm-hmm. when it comes to emotionally supporting Harry, because he didn't really have a chance to become an adult in any meaningful way. And so without, you know, being able to see what James has to say for himself based on only looking at Sirius and Lupin, it's hard to find a whole lot of support. I mean, that's definitely the implication, that they believe at least that James and Sirius to some degree gained maturity over time. And it's hard to see that as a really concrete lesson. But what Harry as a kind of unnuanced, Harry as a character has a hard time seeing nuance and seeing complexity in any of the situations that he's facing. And so I think this is a good example of that, because he's distraught. He has the good sense to be distraught by what he sees in the memory, and he confronts Sirius and Lupin about it, but then he doesn't have much more chance to process it, because the events of that book totally overshadow everything that preceded it, with them going to the ministry, Harry being duped by Voldemort, Sirius's death. And that's shown pretty clearly in the scene after Sirius's death, when Harry is raging and storming around Dumbledore's office. Dumbledore points out that Sirius was not a character without flaws, that he, for example, bullied Creature, and that ultimately contributed to his death in a really meaningful way. And Harry doesn't want to hear it. He says something like, "Don't you dare talk about Sirius that way, because he was so good." Like, Harry has a hard time understanding that kind of the nuanced morality of Sirius. And so, like, another example of a humanized bully is Snape himself. He's later revealed to be another sort of good bully, by showing that even though he bullied Harry and Neville and Hermione in all those ways, that he was ultimately working toward, you know, the greater good, helping Dumbledore to defeat Voldemort. And Harry, I mean, we don't see a whole lot of his mental processing, but it seems like he thinks that this Snape's ultimate good behavior erases all the bad behavior that preceded it. And that's how we get Harry naming his child after Snape, which is kind of unsatisfying, because he's not really seeing that, sure, Snape ultimately did a lot of good things in helping to take down Voldemort, but that doesn't erase the trauma that his bullying of the other children caused. So I guess, like, in sum, I'd say that for a reader to appreciate the nuance of a of the humanized bullies like James and Sirius and Snape, to understand that complexity, the reader has to do that work themselves, because Harry doesn't really do it from his own, in his own self and from his own perspective.
I think that's such a great insight, especially I was thinking about how he has such struggles with Dumbledore and, you know,
yes.
the life and lies of Albus Dumbledore yes. and the reality that Dumbledore also has a maturing process, and that maybe the magic is might is a bullying kind of slogan, and that
the highest order.
Mm-hmm, he was drawn to some of those ideas in his youth, and Harry has such a hard time reconciling the good and the bad, the bullying and also the kind in various characters. And I think you're right to say that the book doesn't do that work for you, but it does give you some opportunities to do that work with these intricate characters. There's an interesting class dynamic at work in the pre-Victorian tales of bullying. And I think we can see a similar dynamic in Harry Potter too. Where do we see race and class intersecting in these interactions among the children at Hogwarts?
Ultimately, I think that nearly all of the bullying that we see tracks race and class dynamics, because even the bullying that is not expressly about blood status is along house lines. It's Gryffindors bullying Slytherins and vice versa, because those houses are so rigid, but also they're so stereotyped. I mean, Slytherins are coded as a class of privileged individuals that can provide a haven for racists in the form of pure blood supremacists, because those are the kind of values that they respect and that they look for. And then you have, on the other hand, Gryffindors being the crusaders against the Slytherins, the defenders of the non-privileged and the defenders of the anti-racists, even though they're not always recognizing the ways in which they themselves might be privileged. And then you have Ravenclaw and Hufflepuff filling other kinds of stereotyped roles like bystanders, observers, model minorities. And I mean, the Potter fandom has done a lot to try to add dimension to this rigid house binary. Like, for example, I have a friend who strongly identifies as a Slytherin herself, and she can very eloquently defend Slytherin virtues that are divorced from the pure blood supremacy ideology. You know, like she's extremely proficient at a networking event, for example, and that seems very Slytherin to me.
Yeah.
Like I said, the Potter fandom has done a lot of that, but I'm not sure that the canon, that the books themselves really support that, because the house interactions are so rigid. I mean, there isn't even a way for students of different houses to interact socially at all. I mean, when Harry is forming Dumbledore's army in book 5, there's some scenes where they're all talking in the Great Hall at breakfast, and they have to like shoo everyone away from the Gryffindor table, because it would be weird to see students of different houses interacting that way. It would be suspicious to the teacher. So I think the houses being so rigid show that, and the ways in which the houses reflect the race and class dynamics between the students shows that even when the bullying is just about Quidditch or the House Cup, that's all coded for race and class. But I'll also mention, it's really important that I'm talking about race only through the allegory of blood status. J.K. Rowling doesn't actually depict race in any meaningful way. She attempts at colorblindness, and it doesn't really land the way that I think she probably meant it. And there's a lot of really good minds out there talking about how problematic that is, looking at, you know, skin color and ethnicity and race as we understand it to be in the Harry Potter series, and how that representation is problematic. But I just want to note that's a problem too, separately from the allegory of blood status for race.
Yes, well noted. And, you know, I think also social class, we get little glimpses of it, but that's also something that it's a little more under the surface. You know, Draco does some bullying of Ron related to social class, and then we see that modeled also in Lucius Malfoy with Arthur Weasley, you know, at the Quidditch World Cup. And so these are, you know, these are lessons that we see in the microcosm of the school experience, and then we also see them in the larger context of the wizarding world. So when people are kind of trying to take lessons about race and class from the bullying experiences kids have at Hogwarts. What are some of those lessons that they might glean from the Harry Potter stories?
I think there are some really valuable lessons about equality that we can learn not only by viewing the bullying dynamics in the series, but by viewing those scenes informed by the kind of bullying that J.K. Rowling herself is doing right now. I'll jump in and say, I hope this doesn't offend too many readers to talk about this, because I know that this could be triggering for some people. When you were talking at the beginning about, you know, who comes to mind when you think of bullying, frankly, I think of J.K. Rowling right now. Things that she's been doing lately, making a lot of transphobic comments, and some other actions related to the Fantastic Beasts films that are sort of in a similar vein. Basically, she's believing that she's defending feminism, but only a kind of feminism that relies on excluding transgender experiences and relying on a biological gender binary. And so the basic idea is that J.K. Rowling has said that Harry Potter is at its core about ending bigotry and achieving tolerance, but the things that she's been doing lately and the things that she's been saying lately are kind of contrary to those morals from the books. Right. And I know that there's a lot of debate about that, but sort of just taking that and going into looking at the scenes of bullying and violence in Harry Potter informed by what she's been doing lately, her actions highlight something from the original series that is pretty easy to overlook because, as I said before, Harry doesn't do the work to understand these interactions. The idea that the resolution of the violent ideologies and the bullying behavior, it never really achieved the tolerance and the end to bigotry that the characters were striving for. In other words, Harry and Dumbledore and company, they won the battle against Voldemort, but they have not yet won the war against pure blood supremacy and racism and bigotry. So some examples that come to mind are Snape, right? He's ultimately considered to be a hero. Harry names his son after him, but we don't ever actually see Snape recant his pure blood supremacist ideology. It seems pretty clear that he sided with Dumbledore and with the side of the good partially to seek vengeance against Voldemort for killing Lily Evans, who he loved, and to help protect the son that she died protecting. But none of that suggests that, you know, in book seven, when he died, he ever believed that Hermione Granger, for example, deserved equal rights. He still bullied her the whole series, that time when, you know, she had the huge teeth because of Malfoy's curse. And he looked at her and said, oh, her teeth look just as normal to me. All of the times that he bullied Neville, threatened to kill his toad just because Neville was displaying a sort of magical weakness that Snape and Malfoy and other Slytherins associated with Muggle-born status. He still did all of that. And nothing about his choice to side with Dumbledore suggests that he recanted any of those actions. But Harry willfully ignores that complicated reality. Snape might have done good actions, but he still supported pureblood ideology, for all we know. We don't see anything to the contrary, and Harry doesn't see anything to the contrary, but he ignores that reality. And even Draco is another example. You know, the times when he sides with Harry, like not turning Harry into Voldemort at Malfoy Manor, that's motivated by the intense threat looming over his family. We don't see anything to suggest that he ever regretted the way that he bullied Hermione and Hagrid and Neville. And similarly, we see some of the way that Harry is willfully ignoring these realities. We see that with respect to Dumbledore. Throughout book seven, up until the King's Cross scene, Harry doesn't know what to make of Dumbledore's past pure blood supremacy ideology. He spends most of that book in a kind of Hamlet-esque wandering through the countryside, like dithering about what to do before ultimately deciding to follow the path that Dumbledore laid out, despite all of his flaws. But he refuses to see any nuance or complexity in Dumbledore as a human, even after he makes that choice. You know, there's a really great scene with Aberforth, when Aberforth is telling them about their childhood and he's confirming all of the horrible rumors that Rita Skeeter wrote about. And there's a whole paragraph where Harry says basically that he made a choice to follow the path that Dumbledore set out for him, to accept that he had not been told everything he wanted to know and to just trust. And And then I'm quoting now, it says, he had no desire to doubt again. He did not want to hear anything that would deflect him from his purpose. So he's really deliberately ignoring the complex reality of these complex people that he was interacting with. So all of these scenes and all these characters reinforce the idea that J.K. Rowling herself might be desperately striving for good and for tolerance and for an end to bigotry. But if you're not willing to look at others and yourself in a nuanced and critical way, you're never going to be able to achieve that end. You know, like J.K. Rowling and Harry and Dumbledore need to consider, you know, okay, am I doing good by defeating Voldemort, by writing a children's story about, you know, defeating a genocidal dictator? Okay, I'm doing good. But also, what are my motivations? Are my motivations, my implicit biases, are those reinforcing, or are they even consistent with the good that I want to do? What are my implicit biases? What are my past behaviors? What are my current biases that inform what I'm doing and why I'm doing it? And this, I'll bring this, circle this back to race and class, insofar as people like J.K. Rowling, Dumbledore, are in their pursuit of tolerance, are considering themselves allies to marginalized people, people of color, LGBTQ people, Muggleborns, people who are bullied for all of those reasons. But the books and J.K. Rowling's actions together reinforce the idea that for a person of privilege to be an ally to people who are bullied, we have to be willing to self-reflect and to reflect about our fellow privileged allies, do the hard work of seeing the nuanced reality. We can't just hide in this sort of binary, you know, Harry Potter, you know, his mindset, where if, as long as you do good, it doesn't matter that you bullied others and that you inflicted trauma on them. You have to see the full reality.
Bravo, Carolyn.
Yeah, that was really a great analysis.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're experiencing this too, but it's so hard to be a Harry Potter fan right now with everything that J.K. Rowling is doing. I mean, every time I speak to, especially fellow millennials, I have to do this dance of, well, I'm a Harry Potter fan, but I don't support what J.K. Rowling is saying right now, but I'm also not canceling her because I think there's a lot to learn. So this is it's a really hot issue right now.
Yeah, and we've talked about this a few times on the podcast too, and I think J.K. Rowling needs to like read her books. She needs to read some Harry Potter, but I think you're absolutely right to kind of tie a little bit of that inability to think with nuance and to put those criticisms onto yourself or even to your heroes, that we see some of that in Harry. And as you were talking, I was thinking like maybe Harry's not even the best representation. Like, I think Hermione can deal with nuance. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And maybe we need Rowling to be a little more Hermione on this, you know, as Hermione sees the privilege with the house elves, especially, that other people are willing to kind of take for granted or to even see as, you know, something that's a good way. And I think one of the things that I got from what you were saying there too is that you can support individuals and be an ally to individuals, and that is a wonderful thing, but you also have to be willing to undermine the structures that create those, you know, race, class barriers, privilege barriers. And that is potentially going to make you uncomfortable and is going to sometimes turn your world around a little bit in ways that are very, you know, that you then have to rethink.
Yes.
It shakes your world. Definitely. Yeah. I was thinking as you were speaking, Carolyn, that I was thinking about Quidditch because I'm usually thinking about Quidditch. But Rowling is writing such a highly symbolic story. And she uses so many symbolic, so many symbols and so much imagery that is, I really think, is meant to be primarily symbolic. And that she's also writing a very, for fantasy, a very realistic story, you know, with a lot of really, you know, intricate plot details that you have to follow in a logical way to understand what's going on. And it's a really interesting mix. And I think that's part of why what makes it so powerful for people. But like Quidditch, there are elements of the story that really only work best on the level of symbols. So you had said, I agree with you 100% when you say that, yeah, they had this goal of ending bigotry and ending this blood purity obsession. But does that really happen? Well, no. I mean, I think the evidence is we don't have any evidence that it really happens. The only thing we have is that at the very end, they're all in the Hogwarts Great Hall and they're no longer sitting according to house tables anymore. And they're all eating together and there's ghosts coming in and out and Grob is being thrown food through the window. But that is a highly symbolic representation of what their goal was. It's not actually the end of bigotry. It's just this nice moment, you know?
Right.
But I think that with that moment, she's trying to say that they made a start to this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right. If that's the only evidence that we have that they succeeded in their goal, it's pretty darn weak, but it works pretty well on the level of symbols. And I think that that's constantly,
right,
you know, where my mind goes, you know, with some of these failings.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that moment is definitely, it definitely is powerful in showing that maybe the heroes of the story have a clue. Maybe they have a clue about what were some of the barriers to their ultimate goal and how can they, you know, create a post-Voldemort world that with those barriers deconstructed. And that would be great, except then we get the epilogue scene where Ron tells his, I think, daughter, you know, if Granddad Weasley would never forgive you if you marry a pureblood. And it's like all of those. And I, the details of the story of Cursed Child are a little bit lost on me, but a lot of that is about this, like the struggle that Albus faces in having been sorted into Slytherin. In, you know, he's the son of Harry Potter and he's sorted into Slytherin. And what does he, how can he find his own way by going so against the grain, so to speak, the Potter grain? And like those really reinforce, I mean, especially the epilogue scene and, you know, to the extent that we care about Cursed Child, that as well reinforces the idea that maybe there was a moment, right? Maybe there was a moment when a post pureblood status world or an anti pureblood status world was possible. And then that moment passed. And the barriers that have been in place for hundreds of years at Hogwarts were re-erected. And maybe there's no Voldemort to, you know, provide like momentum to that movement, but that the movement is still there, you know, in the form of, you know, the same kind of house disputes and Quidditch and the House Cup. And that probably out there in the world, there are the Black families, like, you know, Sirius at one point talks about his family being, you know, definitely supporting the pureblood ideology and maybe not having the stomach for the violence, but definitely believing in that. And that there's, with the house barriers still erected, with no affirmative work to try and deconstruct the systems that supported pureblood supremacy, there's nothing to suggest that there are no Black families still out there, you know, sitting there saying, you know, hoping that the next Voldemort will rise and do it all over again.
I think one of the other areas that we haven't been talking about that is part of this is kind of a hierarchy of abilities and the tradition of bullying as a way of pointing out children who are less capable. And within Harry Potter, it seems like Neville is a great example of a character who experiences very traditional forms of bullying because he's showing these weaknesses, but who changes roles and is shown as being heroic and shown as being intelligent in ways, you know, like a lot of when you're talking about Quidditch, it feels to me a little bit like jock mentality. The idea that we're going to celebrate people who have these physical gifts and physical abilities, and in to a lesser extent, within Hogwarts, there's the idea that somebody who's a dunce or Luna who's dreamy, they're more objects of fun, and I think Rowling's texts often kind of makes fun of them for being less competent and less characters that you want to spend time with. And we do have some evolution of those characters into something more heroic, and that's exciting. But I guess this is another example of kind of how problematic the text is. Rich, interesting, but not necessarily the lessons that you want people to pick up from the surface reading.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, so much of that bullying is used for comic effect in the Harry Potter series, you know? And I mean, I think we could go back to when, you know, even when Hagrid gives Dudley a pig's tail as an act of bullying, but which I know, Emily, you have many thoughts about. But then also the things with Neville, and I mean, I think there are ways in which those are things that are used for comic effect in Rowling's books.
So to bring things back to bullies and bullying, what do the Harry Potter books suggest should be our response to bullies and bullying? And how does it relate to our current way of talking about the subject?
I think that the books do a pretty good job of showing that bullying is complicated and that there isn't any one perfect response to it. You know, sometimes the victims of the bullying respond and it's kind of coded in the book as a good thing. Like there's when Harry's in the Quidditch match and Draco is pretending to be a Dementor and he casts a Patronus charm and in so doing wins the Quidditch match. That's definitely coded as a pretty good thing. There are some times when the comebacks are sharp and satisfying, like when at one point Malfoy is bullying Harry, Ron, and Hermione, I can't remember exactly who, but then Hermione comes back and says, "Oh, hello, Professor Moody," making Malfoy think that Professor Moody is right behind them, and he's not, but it makes Malfoy turn and, you know, look flustered, and then Hermione says, "Twitchy little ferret, aren't you, Malfoy?" Like, times like that where it's just like a little, you know, a little jab, a little snide, you know, something that's kind of coded good. But then there are times when the victims respond, and it's definitely coded as a bad thing. And a really kind of gruesome scene to me that communicates that is when Harry uses the Sectum Sempra curse on Malfoy.
Oh, yeah.
That's just really, I mean, you know, Harry doesn't know the spell, but that in and of itself is risky because, you know, using a spell you don't know what it's going to do is risky. And it's, you know, gruesome dark magic. And that's definitely not, even Harry seems to recognize that that was a mistake. Not just because he can't do the Quidditch match later, but because he didn't mean to cause that kind of harm to Malfoy. But then there are other times when the victims don't respond, and that's coded as a good thing. Like all the times when Hermione tells Harry to just ignore the bullying. And then there are times when the victims don't respond and it's coded as a bad thing. I always thought a kind of funny moment when it's like leading up to Ron's first Quidditch match. Harry and Ron are bullied in a kind of normal and expected pre-Quidditch way. And Harry responds back, you know, insulting the aim of the Slytherin chaser. And Ron doesn't respond because he's so nervous about the game. And Harry is sort of like, you know, he really should, you know, maybe not snap back, but at least not let the bullying bother him so much. And so I think that bullying is, I mean, there's no one response. It's really contextual. It's really contextual also in the sense of how it's handled. Like, for example, I think a really good example of how complex it is when in book five, when Draco Malfoy is insulting Harry's mother and Mrs. Weasley, and then Harry, Fred, and George, you know, all try to beat up on Malfoy. And Professor Umbridge is upset and suspends them from playing Quidditch ever again. And then they're all, you know, very unhappy with that punishment. And Professor McGonagall is like, "Well, you know, that's maybe an extreme punishment, but you absolutely did the wrong thing. Like, you should not have been beating up Draco Malfoy that way." So it's, I'm not sure there really is any one response.
No, that's helpful. It's varied and contextual. I think that relates to, you know, how we think of bullying now. That you know, it's a complex issue, and one response does not really cover things.
I think the schools always try to, you know, they're trying to codify it, you know, so if there's bullying, first you do this and second you do that. I don't know if you have seen that with your kids at all, but,
yeah.
But it is different in different contexts, and it's so hard, I know, for kids to figure that out. And so, you know, I do think that that has this kind of learning experience, and one of the nuanced scenes of kind of a response to bullying that we have talked about before on the podcast is one that also Catherine and Carolyn, you all talk about in your chapter, Old School Bullies at Hogwarts. It's the scene where Hermione slaps Draco in the face.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you all have said you call that, quote, a rather satisfying moment, which I think a lot of people agree with you. And of course, you see the gif of Hermione in the movie punching Draco all the time because it's, you know, there's something very satisfying about that. Well, on our podcast, episode 4, we had an extensive discussion of that scene, both in the book and in the movie. And there was a lot of conflict, disagreement about whether this was the appropriate response. Why do you think this is a satisfying moment, especially when you think about it in the context of these school stories?
The thing about school stories and what makes them powerful is in some ways similar to the reason that fairy tales are powerful, is fairy tales usually or frequently begin with the death of the parent. So it's a child who's being thrust into an environment without protection, forced to discover their own abilities, forced to kind of make their identity from scratch outside of their normal context. And so Hermione is known as an intellectual. That's one of the first things we know about her. And for her to become a physical person and to express her emotion in this way means that she's expanding who she is. And it may not be necessarily an expansion in a positive way, but it is showing that she is no longer just simply the little girl on the train who had done all the reading ahead of time. You know, that she is capable of being her physical, maybe her muggle self as well.
There are several lessons that Hermione is learning in this scene. I mean, she's definitely learning that sometimes it's okay to break the rules. You know, in the first book, she's a very obsessive rule follower. And surely, you know, beating up on your peers breaks some kind of rule. But books 2 and 3 for her are about learning the occasional necessity about breaking rules. In most of those contexts, it's about serving a higher moral purpose. Like she sneaks out of the castle to defeat Voldemort sneaks onto the restricted floor to defeat Voldemort, concocting the illicit potion to discover the identity of the heir of Slytherin, breaking all of the time travel rules in order to free Sirius. Those are like moral imperatives. And this is like an expansion of that lesson, learning that sometimes it's justifiable to break these rules to protect others, in this case, Hagrid, who is very weak and vulnerable when it comes to Buckbeak, and he's emotionally vulnerable by everything that's going on. And that it's also reinforcing her, you know, gradual development of courage and bravery. You know, in book one, she's definitely very, very timid and very afraid. And it's a gradual process where she's learning bravery and courage. And then like Catherine was saying, I think that the choice of a slap compared to like a spell or a curse is really a reversion to her muggle self. I mean, physical violence is a very muggle behavior in this context. And I think that teaches her that she has power in her muggle self in this wizarding world that shames her for that very part of her identity. And not only is she sort of showing that to herself, she's showing Draco, the pureblood supremacist, that Hermione has power not only despite of her muggle background, but because of it. She needs to sort of show that to herself. She needs to show that to Draco. And whether it's, I mean, that's sort of a separate issue from whether it's the right response. But Hermione learns a lot here, lessons that she needed to learn in order to become who she's going to become in books 5 through 7. Like, would she have ever had the confidence or the courage or the sort of certainty in herself as a muggle-born to have so blatantly defied the law in books 5 through 7 to stand up for fellow muggle-borns if she had not learned these lessons? And I think I'll also mention, I think in the earlier podcast episode, you talked about whether it was consistent with her character. And I'd say, I think it's consistent with her development. I sort of disagree with the characterization of it as like a sort of release of the pressure cooker moment. I mean, in the film, I think it's definitely that way, because my recollection is that in the film, there's a sort of a buildup. You know, Draco is taunting her and they're trying to walk her away, and then she just decides at the last minute not to walk away. But in the book, there's really just the one comment. There's not much of a buildup. And so I think that this is the first, I think this is the first example of Hermione in the subsequent books. She exercises a pretty thoughtful and sophisticated approach to when to respond to bullying versus when not to. Like, for example, you know, she's teased periodically by Draco and by Pansy Parkinson for her looks, for having, you know, buck teeth and bushy hair. And she almost never responds to that. But then with respect to Rita Skeeter, I mentioned she's a bully that I'm particularly interested in. Hermione has a pretty sophisticated response to her. You know, Rita Skeeter alleges in her gossip magazine that Hermione is having some kind of illicit romance with Harry. And that doesn't upset her. That doesn't bother Hermione. She brushes that off by saying something to the effect of, well, my parents don't read the Daily Prophet, so I don't care. But the part that upsets her is the invasion of privacy. Like, she picks up on the fact that Rita Skeeter is learning secrets, that learning things that are private, that people wanted to keep private, you know, Hagrid's half-giant identity and the fact that Crumb asked her out. And that, you know, that's sort of injustice at the invasion of privacy is what motivates her to try and, you know, figure out what Rita Skeeter's game is all about. And I think that that's kind of sophisticated. And so I think that part of the scene is the very beginning of that development of her sort of learning that the bullying is really complicated and nuanced, and that there are times to respond and there are times not to respond.
And I love how Hermione like traps her in a jar. The end.
Well, so that part is also satisfying kind of at a gut level, but that's the part that's kind of a little, I think, uncharacteristically mean girls of Hermione.
Yeah, a bridge, you know, too far.
She has kind of a strong principle in terms of not caring about the rumor mongering, but caring a lot about the invasion of privacy and how that seems kind of unjust. But then the way that she traps Rita Skeeter in a jar and then like threatens her to get what they want over the course of book four and book five, maybe a little too mean. But
disturbing. This is where I come in with my, this works better on the level of symbols sort of line.
Oh, fascinating. All right. And I encourage everyone to check out Old School Bullies at Hogwarts in the volume, Cruel Children in Popular Texts and Culture. What a really great conversation. We are now going to turn our attention to kind of continue this issue in our special segment today. Food Fight in the Potterversity Dining Hall. So we asked a provocative bullying-related question on Twitter and got some very interesting responses. And our question was, who is the bigger bully, James Potter or Severus Snape? Now, I do have a sense of what Carolyn especially will say about this. Carolyn, you've given us a lot of insights into what you think about Snape in particular here as a bully. But I thought I would just give our listeners a sense that there was a really nice interchange on Twitter about this. And we had someone chime in right away that James is the bigger bully because he punched down as the popular kid. He's making fun of Snape for laughs while he's surrounded by his popular group friends. And so this was the first throw of the pumpkin pasty, right, in the Twitter dining hall food fight. But this raises this question of what is really the power dynamic. You know, James has power as the popular kid. And of course, there's a class dynamic there as well. His parents have money and Severus's parents do not. But Severus, he's not without Death Eater friends. I mean, such that Death Eaters are friends.
I think I'd rather be in James' situation, but you know, that's just me.
Yeah, but James has Peter, so it's not great. Okay, but there's also the way, and I think Carolyn, you know, could ring in on this. There are the ways that Snape continues with a lot of bullying behavior, even when he's a professor at Hogwarts, with the clear power differential that he has over his students. And so so I thought I would just throw this out to Catherine and Carolyn to get a sense of what you think. James Potter, Severus Snape, who's the bigger bully?
Yeah, bullying an adult, especially an adult in a very powerful position, bullying children is pretty hard to defend. James, we're told, grows out of his bullying, and clearly Severus never does, but his bullying is rising out of a different place. Like, he's one of those damaged bullies, and he was damaged. What James did to Severus leads to his bullying the next generation. So in some ways, this is just sort of the thread of James's bullying kind of manifest itself, you know, 20 years later. So I don't know if you can really separate them in that way.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That it's a cycle that's continuing.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely true, the cyclical nature of it. And I mean, I think James is the most sort of prototypical bully in the sense of being powerful and popular and a jock and bullying down because that's easier, and bullying down to try to get the attention of the pretty girl he likes. That's sort of the most prototypical. It's the most like concrete to us. Like, we, you know, we probably all experienced someone in our schools as children who behaved like James Potter in some way. But even at their age as children, you know, James, it's implied at least that he had a line somewhere. You know, there's this, we learn this much earlier, much longer, like long before we see the memory of the bullying. But as early as book three, I think we learn that Snape was trying to discover what, you know, the Marauders were up to. And so he snuck down to the Shrieking Shack to try to figure out what Lupin was up to. And James saved him from a werewolf fight. And actually, remembering that scene now, Sirius was the one who lured him into that.
Yes,
and James thought that was a bridge too far. And so, I mean, I think that there was a line that James would not cross. But not that these are exactly comparable, but again, at that adolescent age, Snape used a racial slur against the girl who had been his best friend at that time. He called Lily a mudblood, and that was really powerful. And she, it seems like she was really, really hurt and really offended by that. To say nothing of, she always picked up on the fact that he was friends with people who bullied other people. You know, she would talk about how, you know, he was friends with all those Slytherins who would bully her friends and her classmates, and how that was a problem. So, I mean, there's something, I think that James is a pretty prototypical bully, which maybe feels worse to a lot of us because it feels the most realistic, whereas Snape is a bully that has something much more sinister going on in a dark magic kind of way. And that's severe, but it also feels a little bit kind of distant. It's hard, like, you know, it's hard for us muggles to see that kind of bullying in our real world, because in our real world that can be covered and masked so easily.
I think you know, Severus also, as Catherine said too, like, he's been damaged by his home experience as well. And then I think he just gets more damaged as he goes along. And so we can have some empathy for him as somebody who, you were talking about the fluidity of bullies and victims, and he's kind of both of those. And so that gives us a more nuanced view. And so maybe if we were going to ask, we would substitute out James Potter with Sirius. I wonder about Sirius versus Severus. So
that's a whole other can of worms.
Yeah. All right. Go ahead.
Can I just also hold up Lily Evans, eventually Potter, as like a no bullying zone? I just love the influence, because you kind of get the impression, and maybe this is just me, but you kind of get the impression that James grows out of his bullying partly with the help of Lily, who's there to make him aware of
the underdog and their perspective, and the muggle-born and their perspective, and the lesser person. And that's that aspect of Harry that keeps him, his the fact that he's his mother's son, that keeps him from really ever showing that kind of arrogant bullying that that his father displayed, certainly not to any significant degree. And that maybe if Lily would have ended up with Severus, he might have been sort of, you know, cured of his bullying instincts as well. I mean, not cured magically, but kind of influenced out of those bullying instincts.
I don't know, Emily. I mean, I think he's had a chance. Like he's been friends with Lily all that time, and I think he's maybe not open to it, and James is open to it, that influence.
Maybe.
I don't know. Something to ponder, though, the yeah. What ifs.
I think another thing is that ultimately James Potter's role in the series is as a father, and mm-hmm. parents are the antithesis of bullies. I mean, although we know that parents can bully too, but bullying is about you have somebody in power and somebody with no power and using that power incorrectly. And what parents do is they have total power over their kids, and they use it to nurture them and protect them and give them, you know, joy and pleasure. And so I think part of growing into the paternal role is naturally being an anti-bully. And Snape never gets that opportunity.
Lots of fascinating little ways our food fight, different foodstuffs coming into it here.
Got very a lot of
interesting.
Great food all over me.
Yeah. Time to clean
have
up.
A snack.
All right, listeners, check out our Twitter to see what people said. And please also weigh in yourself on this issue. That brings us to the end of our episode today. Thank you so much, Catherine Kittredge and Carolyn Rennie, for being on our show.
It's been a wonderful opportunity. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, definitely. Thank you. This has been really great.
Oh, great conversation. And I hope that you two also enjoyed the chance to once again, you know, mind meld on this topic. We'll close the show with words of wisdom from Hogwarts headmaster, Albus Dumbledore, who is often absent, but then always appears at the end to give you some good wisdom about those school dynamics. And I have two quotes today. I think the first is more recognizable, but both of them seem very apt to me, so I'm going to use both of them. Of course, at the end of Philosopher's Stone, he says, "It takes a great deal of bravery to stand up to our enemies, but just as much to stand up to our friends." And then he also says to Harry, "We must try not to sink beneath our anguish, Harry, but battle on."
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.